Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing. And create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices. Paris.
Families waiting outside the All India Institute of Medical Sciences. 400, sometimes more. This bus stop is the stopover, perhaps a waiting area. All they wait for is the appointment with doctors. Few I spoke with don't care about the new COVID outbreak, and many are even confused what it is and what it does. They say our loved ones are dying anyway due to lack of treatments and medical assistance. Coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant have skyrocketed in India, prompting the government to rapidly reinforce a series of restrictions. The administration of Prime Minister Modi says it is confident and fully geared up to handle any situation in the wake of new COVID outburst, largely driven by Omicron variant. Health experts, however, have urged the government to halt the ongoing election campaigns, which they say could spark another healthcare crisis in the country. On Tuesday, the country recorded 168,000 new infections, including 4,400 cases of Omicron variant. 227 deaths were also reported, based on official data. The overall COVID case tally has increased to around 35 million, while the death count rose close to 480,000. And overall recoveries stand at 34.5 million.
We take things lightly, as usual, and we saw the result in April. Many people think this Omicron is nothing new, but we need to be cautious.
Despite alarming rise in fresh COVID cases, the political parties are busy with election rallies ahead of crucial state polls in five key Indian states of Uttar Pradesh, Punjab, Uttarakhand, Goa and Manipur, which begins February 10. Rallies packed with thousands of people, many without masks, is making health experts worried.
We have learned from first and second wave, and even if we see the private and the public sectors in health sector basically in India, so everyone have leveled up their care practices and they are also providing the specialized care for the COVID.
Over the last 2 weeks, hospital admissions are rising and medical staff has been advised to cut their leaves. New Delhi, Maharashtra, Rajasthan and parts of southern India are reporting maximum cases, including the new variant. Earlier waves of the pandemic unfolded mayhem in the subcontinent. Healthcare collapsed. People begged for oxygen and hospital beds. Graveyards and crematoriums ran out of space. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The pandemic appears to be spiraling out of control in the United States, pushing the country into uncharted territory. Many states are witnessing a dramatic surge in infections. Just in a single day, two new records have been set, sounding the alarm about the severity of the situation. Authorities are now reporting more than 1.3 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. The previous record set last week was just a little above 1 million. The 7-day average has also been soaring in recent weeks. It's now over 700,000 cases a day, three times higher than 2 weeks ago. Deaths have also increased, averaging around 1,700 per day. That's 20% up from 1,400 posted in recent days. Omicron is largely to blame for the rise. The extremely contagious variant is spreading like wildfire in many parts of the world, and the US is no exception. It's the world's worst-hit nation by far, with around 62 million cases and over 800,000 deaths. Vaccine maker Pfizer says a redesigned vaccine is likely needed to specifically target Omicron. US medical centers are already overwhelmed and the Omicron wave is now pushing them to the brink. The number of daily hospitalizations has hit a new peak. Over 140,000 more patients are being treated in hospitals whose staff have already been worn out by the Delta variant. Experts are of the opinion that many Americans' refusal to get their shots is probably one key factor stoking the spike. About 37% of the population has not been fully vaccinated. Some cities like Chicago and New York are imposing restrictions and vaccination rules to curb the trend, the kind of measures that are likely to once more bring anti-vaxxers onto the streets. Whatever the causes may be, the facts speak for themselves. The battle against the coronavirus is a tough one, and the US, already the number one in many global categories, has now one more to add to its records, the world's number one in its failure against the virus.
As Afghans are struggling with a rising hunger combined with harsh winter, the Iranian embassy in Kabul, in cooperation with Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, distributes rounds of aid and food to vulnerable people across Afghanistan.
Iran's humanitarian aid to the Afghan people is continuing in different provinces of Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, we aim to provide vulnerable families with food and warm clothes. Today, these batches of relief assistance, including flour, oil, and rice, are going to be distributed among Afghan teachers and unemployed people.
Unemployment, cash shortage, and the rise in prices have switched many to poverty and hunger. Nowadays, as winter sets in, millions of Afghans are awaiting relief assistance.
We're absolutely in need of such aid. I have a family of 10. We thank Iranian people for helping us in this dire situation. Their aid can help us survive one more month. We also demand Islamic countries and the international community to support us in this harsh winter, as we are short of food and warm shelter.
I'm a teacher and have 8 children. My husband is jobless. I have been unpaid for 4 months. Nowadays, we really don't have anything to eat or heat our houses. Other teachers have the same difficult situation. What should we do if we don't rely on foreign aid? I hope such aid continues for all throughout this winter.
Iran has delivered 14 rounds of aid to the people of Afghanistan since the Taliban took over and the financial crisis in August. This comes as nearly $10 billion in Afghan assets remain frozen by the U.S. and a large number of funds to the country are halted. Harsh winter in Afghanistan is worsening the dire situation, adding to the number of people in need. Most families are relying on such assistance because it is a matter of survival for them. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On January 9th last year, the Hassan family of Somali origin living in Cardiff, Wales, were stricken by grief. Their son, 24-year-old Mohammed Hassan, found dead in his own apartment.
Around 10:30 at night, Mahmoud was discovered by a friend when he tried to wake him up to go to the hospital, and they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff Police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come. Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Sirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, South Korea.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States' assessment of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been problematic since the victory of Iran's revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reiterated the U.S.'s miscalculations regarding Iran. He said Washington thought with its terror assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani that all of his efforts would have been in vain, but the reality, he says, is that the opposite is true. The committed people of Iran are following and continuing his way more now than ever before. So, at the end of the day, what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on The Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said that the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course, or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight out of Berkeley, Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator. And Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome you both to the program. Well, let's start this off in Berkeley. And Paul, your overall assessment, what is it all about, Paul? There's so much animosity that comes from Washington towards Tehran that even started, even leading up to the revolution, even before the revolution miscalculation. What is it all about in your perspective?
Marcia, I think there is what you can call a more global view and also a very short-term view. The situation actually at the time of General Soleimani's assassination was that, let's say, there was an opportunity that was spotted by the military, saying an opportunity for assassination, that is. And it means that they were, of course, watching his movements and preparing for the possibility of assassination. And the short-term view is that they presented that to Trump and to President Trump, and President Trump saw it as an opportunity for him. That is to say, he was not being presented very well in the press, and he decided that an assassination like this, regardless of its actual strategic value, would boost him in the polls and make him appear to be a hero, or at least become a hero in the press, if you will, on a very short-term basis. And he took it. He wanted the glory, if you will, as the United States would see it. But there is another.
Paul, what exactly does that mean? I mean, you say that basically he took the bait. He decided that's what he wanted. He wanted the glory. But the system in the U.S. is not really individual-based as such. Wouldn't you say, I mean, there's something extremely problematic, to say the least, about an entity that sits down and thinks that, oh, okay, so assassinating this general representing another country on a diplomatic mission is actually an opportunity. I mean, let's look at that side of things and what we're saying about that entity.
Well, that's the other side of what I was going to mention. That is to say that there's a larger picture, but on balance, it's very possible that, there were equal sides on the issue, within Washington's and the Pentagon's calculating as to whether they should do it or not. But the side that had a, let's say, a more calculating and long-term view realized that General Soleimani was a problem for the United States because he was eliminating the terror threat in the Middle East, and because he had negotiated with Putin and was important in persuading Putin to join the fight in Syria in a limited way at that time, and because he unified forces in the region and the views, and because he had the respect of all of that, and so in that sense, they wanted him out of the way for these reasons.
Okay. Stay with me, Paul. Yeah. Let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Elijah, in the early days of Iran's revolution, Washington continued to say that Imam Khomeini was going to die any day, and after he would die, then the revolution basically would be over. And we've seen so many different types of miscalculations along the way. And, of course, with the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, I want to talk about that aspect, that it really expected the resistance in the region to be stunted now, to be impeded or to go in another direction by assassinating him. Of course, he was a very, very important figure. But as the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said today, with his assassination or his martyrdom, actually, support for the resistance has grown.
Thank you for having me. I think what really happened is we can't exclude the ignorance of President Trump and the team he had around him to inform him that removing or assassinating General Qasem Soleimani would deter the access of the resistance, would weaken Iran, because everything is related to one man and one man only. And that's pure ignorance, really, because the access of the resistance is made of several population who have decided to fight against the U.S. hegemony and dominance, and they want the U.S. forces outside of their country. Now, that is not depending on one man. It is the ideology, it is the country, it is the principle, and it is the fight behind the cause and not behind one single man. And when President Donald Trump assassinated Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the Daesh emir, he thought that Qasem Soleimani could be more or less the same thing at the same level, and he can get rid of him like he did with Abu Bakr Baghdadi without soliciting any reaction. And what he did in a moment when the color revolution was starting to pick up a little bit in Iran, where people in the street were destroying banks and official institutions, creating havoc in the country, burning gasoline station, etc. And the Americans, with their limited thinking, they thought we can create more, we can give more boost to this movement of the population that the Americans are behind, and we can cripple more Iran and submit it so it accepts the U.S. dominance, and it, at the end of the day, it aligns itself for what we want. This is why Donald Trump impose maximum pressure on Iran to cripple the population and submit Iran. So by assassinating unlawfully an envoy of Iran and an advisor to the Iraqi government in Iraq, in Baghdad, he thought that he can get away with it and it would be a simple act. He didn't realize that Qasem Soleimani boosted a new blood in the revolution in Iran, because we saw millions of people in Iran, but also we saw millions of people in Iraq. And that also helped the axis of the resistance to remember who is the enemy. and that the U.S. should be removed from the area, because the only thing it is doing is just skinning, particularly a general who was the main force behind defeating ISIS in the Middle East.
What about that, Paul? I mean, Elijah said that there's ignorance there, especially dealing with Trump and those around him. But we're not just talking about the 4 years that Trump was president. We're talking about more than four decades of miscalculation in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is that about? I mean, what exactly does that mean? We have many strategists, all kinds of think tanks in Washington and beyond. So, your assessment of it.
Thank you. That's right on point, Marzia. And Elijah is absolutely right. There's one side of it that's based on ignorance. And it's being used by people in the state and adjacent to the state, who are the deep state, you could say, that are using this ignorance for their own purposes. And those purposes are partly, in fact, in large measure, the Zionist purposes of the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But it's also part of and allied to a deep state that wants to impose by military force its domination of other countries, and other countries which are currently dominated by the United States and which have puppet regimes of the United States installed there are sort of left alone. They're not, you don't see the U.S. Destroying those countries except by exploitation. But the other ones, which insist on being independent, and Iran is certainly a nation that wishes to remain independent, as does Syria and Iraq and Venezuela and North Korea and Nicaragua and Cuba and on and on. There are these that are considered problem states, problem countries that the United States has to deal with. And what the policy towards those countries has been, and still is, that these countries have to be taught a lesson. And at the very least, they have to be destroyed. If they won't submit, then they have to be destroyed as an example to other countries as to what happens to them. So this, and this is very much part of the Zionist thinking, which benefits the State of Israel by using the U.S. military to fight the perceived enemies of Israel. So those two, those interests are very much allied with each other, and that's not a case of ignorance. This is a case of very deliberate use of military force, economic force through sanctions, so-called sanctions, and destruction. And this is a theory of how the United States can continue to remain in power throughout the world.
Well, Elijah, continuing on that theme, I mean, do you think that it is because of a lack of understanding about Iran that there still is so much animosity and the actions that are taken against Tehran? Or is it actually because they have a very, very good understanding of Iran and the possibilities of Iran and its support, not only support for the resistance, but actually being the leader of the resistance?
I can't say that the U.S. has a good understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, because we saw what the Americans did in Afghanistan after 20 years. We saw what they are doing in Iraq. They were asked to leave in 2011, and now they are asked and will be forced to leave. We saw what they've done in Syria. They're occupying a part of Syria, and they don't know what to do to remain or to leave, and they really can't figure out what's the best solution. We see what they are doing in Lebanon, and yes, I agree with your guest about the element of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu at the time when Donald Trump wanted the support of the Israelis in his re-election. And actually Donald Trump blamed Israel for not going to war against Iran. Well, the Israelis are much more clever than the Americans at that time, because they know what the cost of a military confrontation with Iran, and what would be the consequences and the cost. Well, I think the Americans, everything they have done in the last decade was a total failure. From the beginning, when they say we're going to Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, they haven't been able to do that, to destroy Taliban. They negotiated with the Taliban, who are back in power. They say in Iraq they want the weapon of mass destruction. What they have managed to contribute in the rise of a resistance that is part of the axis of the resistance, that was directed its strength and its attack against the U.S. forces. Now in Syria, it's picking up. In Lebanon, they were kicked out in the 80s, and now they're trying to come back with the sanctions. So I don't see any clever policy of the U.S. apart from an elephant in a china shop, just breaking left, right, and center, and then leaving without even saying, I'm sorry, and say, well, what I have destroyed is only the consequences of what I have done, and you can live with it, because there is no accountability. This is why the Americans can do what they are doing, because they fear and consider they have no consideration to international law, and they have no consideration to any law whatsoever, because there is no accountability.
Well, Paul, your take on what Elijah said as far as the United States not having any accountability, I want to look at overall how this miscalculation, whether we're talking about with Iran or Afghanistan or Lebanon or Syria or so many examples that Elijah just brought, what has it done to the United States itself?
Well, I don't think you'll find many people in Washington that will admit to a miscalculation, and that includes the think tanks and the part of Washington that studies very carefully what's going on and so forth. But there's a lot of disagreement between the forces in Washington, and there's also a lot of arrogance. So you and I may call it a failed policy, but the.
If we just take Afghanistan, I mean, 20 years and how much money spent and leaving the way they did, I find very few Americans would say that was successful policy that they adhered to in Afghanistan.
Correct.
With the results, if we look at it.
Yes, that's what they would say, but that's not what they say in Washington. What they say in Washington is that this is time well used, because the influence of what's going on in Afghanistan, it gave them a presence in the Middle East, and it pushed and it gave a warning to adjacent countries, don't mess with us, and all this kind of thing. This is the way they think. This is what I'm telling you. I'm not saying it's a good way of thinking. Right. I'm saying that this is the so-called expertise that they have there, and they would say, yes, we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve in Iraq, but on balance, it's still very useful. And as long as there's war going on and there's a war economy in the United States and the United States can destroy anybody on the face of the earth, we're in a good situation. That's the kind of thinking you're dealing with.
Okay. Elijah, we just have about 1 minute. Your overall assessment, the United States, especially after the assassination of General Soleimani, many would say that the reputation, whatever was left of it, has deteriorated rapidly. Your analysis of the United States right now in the region compared to prior to the assassination, how it has deteriorated and where do you see it going from here?
I think the assassination of Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani brought something new to the Middle East. Soleimani's death is more feared by the U.S. than when he was alive. And I think this has raised the awareness to so many people about what the Americans are doing in the area, in the Middle East, and what they are capable of, and how they think they can do whatever they want. And people are working to push the Americans outside the Middle East now as soon as is possible. And we see what's happening today in Iraq, where they are attacked every single day just for the Iraqi to make a point and say to the Americans, just leave us alone. We can sort out our problems without your presence.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here. Paul Arudi, activist and political commentator out of Berkeley. Elijah Magnier, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us right here.
The Limelight.
In the years after 2001, the United States and its allies created the most aid-dependent state in the world. Upon withdrawal, almost all of this aid has been cut, and further sanctions limit almost all financial transactions with the country. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Matthias Gresdal-Hammer, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. sanctions are causing a humanitarian disaster in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for more. The people of Afghanistan are starving. A perfect storm of droughts, economic implosion, and the suspension of most development aid have come together to create an increasingly volatile humanitarian catastrophe. As winter goes ahead, estimates suggest that as many as 22 million people will be close to starvation. In the years after 2001, the United States and its allies created the most aid-dependent state in the world. Upon withdrawal, almost all of this aid has been cut, and further sanctions limit almost all financial transactions with the country. As a recent report from the International Crisis Group put it, donors' decisions to cut off all but emergency aid is the biggest culprit of Afghanistan's dire situation. Indeed, one UN expert quoted in the report suggested that the sudden withdrawal of aid in Afghanistan is the greatest shock any modern economy has ever faced, as 43% of its GDP disappeared virtually overnight. The sanctions regime is so strict that many NGOs overcomply for fear of punishment. The specifics of these rules remain unclear, with one international business concluding that it could most likely pay regular taxes to the Taliban, but not fines for late payment, which are all but inevitable due to the collapse of the banking sector. Moreover, even humanitarian aid is dependent on basic state provisions such as cell phone towers, hospitals, and sanitation systems, which are currently all run by the cash-strapped Taliban and are not eligible to receive any aid. Sanctions, of course, are a tempting mechanism of statecraft. They come at a perceived minimal cost to the United States and have increasingly become one of America's favorite foreign policy tools. Even so, research on their usefulness is almost unanimous that they rarely succeed. Most notably, Robert Pape of the University of Chicago studied 115 cases of sanctions from 1914 to 1990, revealing that in only 5% of cases did sanctions lead to the desired change in behavior. Researchers have since found some situations in which sanctions may be more effective, such as where the stakes are relatively low, for example, releasing political prisoners. When the sender and target don't foresee subsequent conflicts, and when the targeted state is democratic. Clearly, none of these criteria are met in this case. Domestically, Taliban can shore up its support by blaming the United States for its role in creating this economic crisis. Survey experiments show that Afghan civilians are much more likely to blame external agents for their suffering than the Taliban already, and a brutal sanctions regime is only likely to add to that sentiment. Outside of Afghanistan, the consequences of the harsh sanctions will also be felt. Over the past few months, emigration to Europe has skyrocketed, with human traffickers telling journalists that their business has already doubled. As the situation only worsens, it's likely that these numbers will only increase. What might a reorientation on Afghanistan look like? Washington could also enact several more specific policy changes that would serve to alleviate Afghanistan's suffering. Currently, sanctions designed to punish the government are essentially being applied to an entire Afghan state. These could be limited to listed numbers of the members of Taliban rather than also impacting bureaucrats who have just stayed on in their roles after the takeover. Moreover, the existing sanctions regime only allows money for critical humanitarian relief to be sent to Afghanistan. Basic services such as healthcare, education, electricity, and water supply all fall outside of a strict criteria for emergency relief. Allowing more extensive aid provisions and reopening the World Bank's $1.5 billion Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund to do this would go a long way to alleviate suffering. And finally, some mechanism for reopening Afghan financial services is necessary. This could take the form of reviving and closely monitoring the Afghan Central Bank, setting up an external central bank, or instituting large-scale currency swaps that the United Nations or World Bank could manage.